My mind is a gift that was given to me for my use. The quality of my life is determined by the choices I make, not the thoughts in my head.
Okay, so in this chapter of the book, we deal with the mind. And you start things off by describing that there's three different types of thoughts: untrue, unreal, and other people's thoughts. Can you expand on that a little bit for us, Ned?
Yes, I'm gonna back up a little bit here first, and I'm gonna say that in our mind, we have thousands of thoughts a day, hundreds of thousands, and it's sort of controversial how many, but it's suggested that 40 to 100,000 thoughts is standard for our thoughts a day. So out of the 100,000 thoughts that you're having every day, there's a portion of those thoughts that are not real, not true, and they're not yours. Now, this is something that I learned with the Ashaya monks. And when they said, some of your thoughts are not yours, I'm like, there can't be anyone else thinking in my head. But we're talking about thoughts. Thoughts drop into your mind. So we have no control over what thoughts come to us. Can you tell me what your next thought's going to be?
No.
No. And you could decide what you're going to think about. So I'm going to think about, we're on drum gap. We're going to think about drums for 5 minutes, 20 seconds and do that. We could time it down to the second, but we can't say in the next millisecond what thought's going to drop into our head. So I'd like to kind of break it down here. Mm-hmm. So there's the thoughts that aren't yours. And this is the one that I had a problem with. When I started to look at my thoughts and take inventory of my mind, I noticed that there was a lot of thoughts in my head. There was thoughts that my parents had said. There's things that my parents had said to me. There were things in my mind that my friends had said to me. There were things that my brother had said to me, my partners. And so my mind was full of other people's words. So that wasn't my thoughts, really. Mm-hmm. And then there was a portion of my thoughts that weren't true. There would just be random thoughts dropping in my mind. Say, like, I'm sitting here with you. My mind could all of a sudden say, I don't think Seamus likes me. So that, or, you know, just random stuff pops into the mind. And just because a thought drops into you doesn't make it true. Sometimes when we just back up from that just a touch, we realize, like, okay, that's an assumption. That may not be true at all. So mm-hmm. there is a portion of those, let's for argument of stake, there's 100,000 thoughts coming to us every day. So a portion of those will be untrue. And then the thoughts that are not real, I categorize those thoughts as the thoughts that we project into the future. We have a certain amount of thoughts where we're saying, this is what I want down the road. And then we have a portion of our thoughts are about the content of things that have already happened. So the thoughts about the past. If the thoughts dropping into your mind are not about what's unfolding now, I call that an unreal thought because it's not happening now. So that's the three different types of thoughts that I categorize in the book. What I also do is I try to make it known to people that these thoughts that are coming into you are not you. You know, you're not your thoughts.
I'm not my thoughts.
Yeah.
So if I'm not my thoughts, then who am I? And where do thoughts come from in that case?
So I'll throw this back at you. If you couldn't think, would you die? Would you cease to exist?
No, I'd still be here, wouldn't I?
Mm-hmm. And that's, we tend to think that we are found in the collection of thoughts that are dropping in our mind. Who we are is that we are a soul. We're not a collection of thoughts. Thoughts are just energy moving. And what makes a thought come alive is the attention and the energy that we put into it. So whatever, if you have a thought in your mind that like this thought about we're doing a podcast. You had a thought, let's ask Ned if he wants to do a podcast. You know, you could have just let that thought go, but you see the life that it's taken now. We're sitting here and we're recording a podcast. So a thought has about as much life as what we give it. And it's not who we are, but we tend to wrap our identity with the thoughts that are dropping into our mind.
Right.
You know, the who we are is we are souls. The truth of our being resides beneath the thoughts. They go a little bit deeper within us.
You say that a thought is only as real as the energy or the effort that you put into it, and you use the podcast as an example. So I could see it being the case, like if we were to talk about untrue thoughts for a minute, and if I was really self-conscious socially, and whenever I'm in a crowd of people, I feel like I stand out in a bad way because maybe something happened to me years ago that was embarrassing, and then from there on out, I feel like that kind of sticks to me a little bit. So every time I'm in a social situation, I'm always thinking, oh, all eyes are on me. So how do our past experiences, how do we shake that off? Like, how do we shake off past experiences to not influence our thoughts to that degree where we actually think that that's always the case, that that's actually real when it may not be at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, it starts with noticing. You have to notice where your thoughts are going. So you have an awareness of your tendency in what can happen to you. So our awareness of that is the start of how we change our relationship to that thought. So we tend to just place all of our attention on our mind, and we're kind of stuck up there. And when we just pull back from our thoughts a little bit and watch the mind, that's the start of the change of our relationship.
What do you mean by watching your thoughts?
So, you know, it's a difference between playing baseball or watching baseball. When you're playing it, you're in it.
But how do you watch your thoughts?
You pull back. You if you're watching baseball, you sit back in the stands. So your attention is not on your, you know, your attention's not in your head. You're just watching the mind like it's a movie. Mm-hmm. And that changes your position with what's going on. It's the difference between playing and watching.
So how much, let's say that we're, okay, so with that knowledge, let's assume that people begin to watch their thoughts. How can you be so sure that you're actually watching them and not dwelling on them? Because like I see that as being kind of a fine line before like you start investing in them in a little further way than simply just watching them.
Well, the dwelling on them would be your response to the thought. Watching the thought has no response.
Okay.
So you would have to be having a commentary with those thoughts to be dwelling on them. If you were simply watching them, they're just going to keep moving. Thoughts don't stop and stay suspended in you. They come in and they keep moving until they actually come out of you. What suspends and holds a thought in place is your commentary. So you'll begin to talk to that thought. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps you stuck in it. So watching your thoughts is the ability to not talk back to the thoughts that are coming into your mind.
So you don't want to take ownership of the thought. You just want to see, okay, that's going through my head, but I'm not going to engage with that.
That's right. And you do that silently. You just, mm-hmm. you just learn how to pull back and watch. What I do mentoring with people in the community, and it's one of the first things I do when people come in to see me. I ask them to sit down for the next week until we meet again. I want them to watch their thoughts and start taking inventory. And that's a really important part to changing your relationship with your thoughts and getting away from thoughts that are self-defeating is understanding what's happening between your ears. Like you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of subconscious thoughts going on. Mm-hmm. So I ask people, take inventory. And you, the listeners, right now, have a pen and paper for the next week. chart your thoughts. See what's happening. See what's happening in your mind.
Let me ask you with that then. Because you say, like with the Ashaya monks, they had instructed or they had told you that your mind has thousands of thoughts every single day, and that 60 to 80% of them are the same thoughts. Okay, so what I have to wonder with that, is that going to be uniform with everybody who takes part in that exercise? Do you really think that like every single person, if they were to take inventory of their thoughts, that there would be an overwhelming similarity of thoughts throughout that course throughout the day?
Yeah, and if you were to move away from town, your hometown, and go back 20 years later, you'd probably find the same people telling the same stories in the same spots, doing the same things day in, day out. This information that we have 60 to 80% of our thoughts are the same day in, day out. Mm-hmm. It, from my understanding, that was taken from a Harvard study. Mm-hmm. So the mind is literally on repeat and we don't realize it. A healthy relationship with your mind is you learn how to pull back and not be affected by these thoughts.
Right.
You know, not to continuously think about the same things over and over again. The mind's going to do what it's going to do. It's mm-hmm. going to keep dropping the same thoughts at you. And what keeps those thoughts alive is you grabbing onto them and thinking about them.
I remember the old man who said he'd had a great many troubles in his life, but the worst of them never happened, by James A. Garfield.
So some thoughts that might enter your mind, they'll provoke a feeling. Like those thoughts will provoke a feeling. Certain things will make people uncomfortable. Certain things will make people sad, happy, angry, you name it. But what if my feelings suddenly become overwhelming? How do I stop that from happening?
Okay, that is a practice.
Now, does this work in conjunction with watching them? Like, is that like your first step to not claim ownership so that it can now manifest into a feeling?
That's right. It's a practice. We start out with understanding what's in the mind, and then we start to see our relationship with the thoughts that are coming to us. We'll notice that certain thoughts, when they arise, that we have a certain relationship with those thoughts. So the practice is to stop yourself from thinking about every thought that comes to your mind. And we do this when things are good, and it's easier to do when you're having a great day. So when you have a bad day and your thoughts get stronger, that you have this practice in place. You know, you can't, it's like you can't be in the middle of a hurricane and learn how to tie knots. You know, you if you're trying to tarp a tent or something like that.
Right.
So you want to practice this in your everyday life. So when thoughts are coming to you, we're not just, the idea is that we're not talking back to them constantly.
So in other words, it's the equivalence of prepping for disaster, that we need to start putting this into motion now before you have an experience that provokes a thought that is potentially quite dangerous to us.
That's right. And if your feelings become overwhelming, this may be a warning that your relationship to those thoughts is out of check, that there's something there that we need to heal in ourselves. We're out of balance in that area of our life. Generally, the thoughts that become overwhelming to me were parts of me that I wasn't willing to look at, or the parts of me that needed some love, needed some healing, and it needed my attention.
Are sometimes these things as well, like the most deep-rooted things that happen quite early on in our lives? And I want to ask you, how do we accurately identify what those things are? Like, it could be severe embarrassment. It could be an abusive relationship with family. It could be any of those types of things that could happen when you're young, especially when we're more vulnerable in our adolescence and we don't really have everything quite together yet.
That's right.
Those things can really have a way to penetrate quite deeply. Mm-hmm. And if we do ignore them by creating other habits that are vices to us, but they seem like temporary solutions, and we can, you know, that could be a whole lot of things. I'm sure listeners can dream up a handful right off the top of their head what that might be. How do we find what those things are?
They're triggers. Okay. So, and this is a topic that we're going to go in a little bit deeper as we get further into this dialogue. There are triggers that are signaling a wound from the past to come forward. So they bring up the past in us. Mm-hmm. If you feel insecure, if I say something that threatens you or that makes you look insignificant, you may jump on that right away and attack me, or in your mind you might start having a crazy amount of thoughts. So you're being triggered in that moment. So that's where we learn to, it once we start to back up from the mind and understand what's happening in our mind, that we can start to see these triggers more clearly, and then we can trace it back to the events that are surrounding the circumstances of what we're being triggered by.
Gotcha. So yeah, we'll explore that later on. That's really fascinating to me, by the way. That's really quite interesting. Now, I talk to people on my show quite often about the zone, and all musicians understand what that means. You, in fact, describe it as that as well, or the silence. Mm-hmm. You describe it in a few different ways in the book, but it all equates to the same result. It's this temporary distraction from your realities. And if you have a really fractured mind, it can actually, you know, it can temporarily relieve you. And so therefore we start craving those situations. So talk to me more about the silence. Talk to me about what that actually is and how it impacts us in the way it does.
Mm-hmm. The first off, the silence is more than a distraction. It's the totality of all that is. For within the silence, we find the source of who and what we are. That comes right from the depth of my being. We come to the silence, we just dip our toe into it. We have these experiences, and this is what happened to me when I was tattooing. I was dipping my toe into the silence, and I was having these experiences with it. A lot of people, they'll try meditation, or they'll just kind of barely dip their toe in it, and then they conclude that it's nothing. Mm-hmm. But the reality and the truth of the silence for me is that it is the totality of who I am. I find the pure essence of the divine in me through entering the silence. Thomas Troward is one of my favorite authors, and he was an author from the New Thought movement. And this is something he said, and it reminds me of how we sometimes will just dip into the silence a little bit, and we think it's not, we don't realize how vast and how massive the silence is. So Thomas Troward says, if we approach the ocean with a small cup and only leave with a small cup of water, we then cannot say that the ocean was not bountiful, that the ocean held back from giving to us. What we need to do is approach the ocean with a bigger cup. And that's the thing about the silence. The more you dive in, it's like you're going to it with a bigger cup. If you dive in a little bit, then the silence just gives you a little bit. As you dive deeper and deeper into yourself, you realize that the silence is a vast ocean inside of us.
Your true self is found under the voice in your head. It is by going deeper into yourself that you discover a greater depth to your existence.
So my curiosity with that, so you and I are both creatives. I'm a musician. I do this podcasting thing. You're a tattoo artist, and you also are an author, among other things as well. But that is an opportunity for you to experience that. Now, what I have to question is, if there are people in the world that don't consider themselves a creative, or they're thinking of this conversation and they're trying to relate to it, and how do I find the silence? Maybe they don't have an outlet. Can you find the silence in everyday activity? Like, does it have to be a creative pursuit that you find that? Because I know, like, for an example, with musicians, that's what they talk about in performance. That's their outlet, to find that. And I don't even know if half of them even know to which depths that actually is and how significant it is in this context here. So I got to wonder, you know, is there a way for people to tap into that if they don't consider themselves a creative?
Yeah, and there very much is. The silence in you is as close as your next breath. That was a phrase that my old teacher used to say all the time. It's as close as your next breath. The silence in you is, it never leaves. And it's the part of us that we can just learn how to relax into. Generally, we have to we need a vehicle to tire ourselves out or to drive us into singular or one-pointed thinking. So when we become one-pointed, and that was happening while I was tattooing, I'd become one-pointed. I was doing one thing, focused on that, and then by bringing our focus, sharpening our focus onto one thing, we were stopping all the chatter in the mind. Mm-hmm. And then I would slip into the silent space found in me. It would just naturally happen. But you don't have to be an artist to do that. You could be washing dishes and the silence just sort of springs forth. You could be walking. You could be changing your child and the silence in you could just spring forth. It's a matter of taking our attention and placing it inward toward the heart, going a little bit deeper in ourselves and removing the attention that we put onto our mind.
Yeah, because I could see people spending a lot of time, again, in their cranium, just thinking, how do I get the silence? And then brainstorming ways and how to get there. So what you're suggesting is, it's more important to identify what the silence is rather than what you have to do to achieve it. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, the route we take to go into the silence, you know, there's thousands and thousands of routes. There's no one single way to go into that silent place in ourself. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do I breathe? How do you breathe? Just one breath at a time. And it's just, we just pull it inward. So the same as with the silence. You go inward. You just turn in.
And this is just being more present, being present in the moment. Will that achieve that result too?
It helps. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It helps.
Something else that you talk about in the book that's really, really interesting is how our mind has a way in organizing events into a linear fashion. And you could say A to B to C. But you're suggesting that life moves more like A to R to H to Q, being that life in itself is non-sequential, but that your mind is. So your mind likes to predict outcomes as a result, and then we as people then start to create expectations. And I want to quote a sentence from the book that anger is unfulfilled expectations. So what tools and practices can we employ to eliminate expectations from our lives and just allow our life to unfold?
That's a good question. The statement, the quote that you pulled out of the book, anger is unfulfilled expectations. That there's an interesting story about that quote. Is I had this old chiropractor was coming to see me at the time. I learned how to do Reiki. And so he was friends with the doctor that I met and had taken me under his wing. And so this older gentleman, John, his name was John, he would come and get Reiki sessions from me usually about once a week. So I became pretty close friends with this guy. He was interesting because he went through the very first chiropractic college in Toronto. So he was kind of like the first of a new era and he was kind of a trailblazer and an interesting sort.
Okay.
So the 1 week John comes in and he come in for this Reiki treatment, which is supposed to bring healing and peace. And I'm pissed. So I said to John, he was a very observant guy. So I knew right away he would know where I'm, he would have a good sense of where I was at.
Right.
And I said, John, I'm really angry today. I just give me a second to check myself here. And he says to me, what'd you expect? And I'm, what do you mean? He says, what'd you expect? He says, you're angry, right? I said, yeah, I'm angry. I'm pissed off. Well, what did you expect? He says, if you must have expected something to go a certain way, and when it didn't, you got angry. Is that the grounds for your anger? And I said, yeah. It's like you knew the scenario. How did you know that? And he says, well, that's the problem with anger. It's unfulfilled expectation. Right. So that quote has come to me so many times over the years and been a wonderful tool. And how that relates to what you said at the beginning, the mind assembles things in a linear fashion. We tend to think life is rolling out A to B to C, but life is actually happening in a non-linear way. And when we get to session 5 of this series, we're gonna really go deep on this concept. So listeners, hang in there, get to session 5 at least, because we got some really interesting topics. It's guaranteed to blow your mind. So answer to your question, the mind makes sense of the events in our lives if it arranges it into a linear progression. And because the mind tracks events this way, it tends to predetermine outcomes based on the past. And the mind always does this. It likes to predetermine what's going to happen in the next 10 yards. So if we eliminate this, by staying in the moment and letting go of the mind. If we could just do that, our expectations would be gone, and we would allow life to unfold the way it's going to. The thing is that we can't force life to fit into the narrowness of our mind. Life is such a vast, complex equation, and we try to squeeze that vast equation to fit this narrow view of thinking. So life very seldomly is going to meet your expectations. It's not going to fit into your predetermined outcomes. And when we try to force it into that, that's the grounds for a great deal of our upsets in life.
So, I mean, if this is something that people do, because that's naturally what the mind wants to do, and before understanding something like that, that's how it's going to go down. That quote, though, I remember when I read, that's why I had to pull it, because when I read that, that speaks to just about every time I was most pissed off, or I saw others that were like that as well.
I know.
Because yeah, there was something that they had expected, but I'm not a mind reader, nor is anyone. I mean, we can have pretty strong intuition and get a fairly good gauge of things, but if we have a lifetime of thinking this way, and this is the way that we're developing as people, how long does it take and how challenging could it be for someone to switch their way in thinking, to let their life unfold, to put their mind down? That seems like quite a tremendous task to, like that, all of a sudden just put the mind down, let things unfold. How long did it take you? Let's ask you, like, how long did it take you to develop that ability?
I'm still working on it.
Yeah. So we're talking a lifetime.
It is. It's a concept until it becomes a practice. And then it becomes, for a while, starts to become your response. And then eventually, when you can just keep setting the mind down and allow the moment to present, you know, what's actually here, we start to catch and understand the sacredness of what's going on around us. And that's something that the mind can't perceive, is the vastness of this moment. And again, that kind of is a preview of what we're going to talk about in session 5. We're going to go really deeply into the topic of the vastness of this moment and how this moment expands from now to eternity, backwards and forwards.
But with your state of consciousness now, in the length of time that you've been practicing this, how much of an improvement have you noticed with your ability to witness the moment, and how much peace have you been receiving from just this one practice?
It's been a valuable tool. There's been times that I've been more and less willing to do so. And I think that has a lot to do with it. My awakening is not yours. And that's the thing, that, you know, your awakening doesn't have to mirror mine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe you're a faster learner than me. Maybe I've got a lot more learning to do yet. But how my awakening has unfolded has been that, you know, there's a lot of sideways movement in the path. There's a lot of, we trek sideways more than we ever go forward.
Sure.
So it's the mind wants to make a mark in the sand and say, how fast can we get to the next mark? But it's not so much about that. The path that we're on is not so much about getting to the next place. It's about just practicing to return to this moment and enjoy where we're at.
Mm-hmm. So the big takeaway of what you said that is enormously valuable is that your awakening, I'm speaking to the listeners here, theirs will be different than mine and different than yours. And so we should not be looking at other people's progressions with how they're doing with something. We need to focus on ourselves.
That's right. So to set up a dynamic where we would weigh my experience against yours would not be purposeful.
Yeah, yeah. I love it.
It may make me look like a very slow student.
Now, there's something else that you talk about in the book, is the seven rooms of the mind.
Yeah, this is... I had so much fun writing this portion of the book. It's almost like a little... Like the little impish part of me just kind of leapt onto the pages. And I talk about the dysfunctional rooms in your mind. The mind is made up of many rooms. What fills the rooms of your mind is unique to your life and your own experiences. Mm. So, and then the thing with the rooms of the mind is they tend to steal all of our attention. By decluttering these rooms in your mind, you can start to have a lot more mental freedom. So by defining all these rooms, I sort of broke down the major rooms that exist in my mind. Mm-hmm. So that list of rooms is, you know, the money room, the self-image room, the lemming room, the sex addiction pleasure room, the relationship room, the fear room, the guilt and suffering room. So that's seven different rooms that I think a lot of people have. A lot of people, like the first room, the money room, a lot of people have a place in their head where they go and they stress about money, and they in that room they tend to ruminate on how much money they're going to have in the future. And, or they ruminate on how much money they don't have now, or how much money they need right now. And, you know, it's a very real thing. Like it can be stressful. It's a place that we go.
Well, think about this for a moment. I mean, going back to what we were just discussing with anger is unfulfilled expectations. What if your expectations in the money room is that you're going to get a raise if you do these certain actions and you get approval from your boss and you're doing a great job, and even maybe you're told you're going to get a raise and it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. you know, or you want to have something, and we're going to get into this in the next section, but you desire something and money is going to provide it, but you can't actually afford it, it turns out, because something came up. Maybe your tax return. I've seen this on Facebook where people will say, oh, you know, I thought I was going to get money back. Turns out I owe. Mm-hmm. And now this thing that I really wanted, that I've been thinking about and expecting, is not going to happen. And their whole world shuts down for a bit.
Well, that takes us back to the beginning of this talk. And that's the problem, is that we as a society put a great deal of emphasis on our peace and our happiness coming from an external object. And that's the problem, you know, and money, the money will tie into this because the money, it generally takes money to obtain the things that we want, that we think are going to make us happy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, you know, I put the money room first because it's generally one that, that affects a great deal of things.
So to conclude this session, there is a sentence within this chapter. This is great. I love this one. It says, your mind is the barrier to your freedom. That's quite a statement. I mean, the depth of that is that's pretty significant. So what I want to know is how can people get out of their minds and begin using their hearts to experience their lives? Because this is sort of, going forward, this is going to come up a fair bit, mm-hmm. using our hearts to guide our decision-making and getting out of your head and not letting that make every single decision or just being stuck up there and literally shackling you to one position. You know, so that's what I'm curious about is how we can begin using our hearts to experience our lives instead.
Well, first off, I have to credit the source of that quote. That quote came from my meditation teacher when I was with the Ashaya monks. And that's something that he said many times to us. And it's a voice or it's a thought in my head that I find useful, you know, and it just reminds me that my mind can be a barrier to my freedom. If I'm trapped in my mind, I'm not resting deeper into my soul. And when, if that thought arises in me, I suddenly drop my thoughts. It's a great reminder to drop your thoughts. And how do we experience getting out of our mind? It's a matter of practice. We have to be willing to practice and then doing it. It's not such a complex equation. What makes it very difficult is that we're not taught to ever set our thoughts down. We're taught there's a paradigm in your mind that says, I need to be a good thinker. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking is important. Being a critical thinker is important. But can you look back into your past and remember a time when you were given specific instructions on how to stop thinking?
No.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, I was told to knock it off, cut it out. But that sort of pertained to my emotions or what I was doing.
That's actually not necessarily true, what I just said, if I'm honest. Because even today, my wife Amanda sometimes will say, you're overthinking.
Okay.
And overthinking that. And this tends to be not so much with my relationships, although that has also been a part of
but
it.
But I'm talking about your formative years when you were kind of laying down the foundation of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever taught to how to stop thinking for periods of time?
Well, no, that's never been taught to me.
No. And it's something that because we're not taught, we may get told later in life, stop thinking, get out of your head for a while. You know, when we notice that we're being overrun by that experience, we may get a reminder from someone who loves us. Mm-hmm. But as growing up as a child, nobody ever told me that it's important to learn how to set the mind down and to put distance between you and your thoughts. That there's a healthy relationship that has to be created with the mind. And how we achieve this is by starting a practice, understanding what's in the mind, what's pulling us deeper into the mind, and learning how to back up from that just a little bit.
Oh, certainly. And what was the following one?
The next one was the self-image room.
Talk to us about that.
How about I read you what I wrote in these rooms?
Sounds great.
I think that'd be kind of entertaining because I would really like the listeners to buy my book, but you know, like I think we can give away a bunch of this book in these dialogues because I just there's parts of it that I think is really great to share. So I'll just read the different rooms and they're really funny and
sure.
And I think they strike a tune in me, and they hit it. They strike a tune in other people. They can people can relate to this.
Because I think some of this, what you're about to say, is also going to ground part of what we've already discussed.
Certainly. Okay, so the money room. It's practical to have a healthy relationship with your money room, but the money room likes to draw you in to worry about money. Still, some people will go to great lengths to feel safe in this room. When they feel that the money room is out of their reach, they will spend a great deal of time sitting in this room, worrying and fussing about their money or lack thereof. Other people don't worry whether they have money or if they don't have it. So that's the first room. The second room, the self-image room. For some people, the self-image room can be an elaborate room full of things. Well, for others, it might just be a closet. The elaborate, overcrowded room will be full of voices saying things like, you need to have a great body, nice clothes, expensive jewelry, and cars. In this room, you'll sometimes feel good, and other times, you'll feel badly. While visiting this room, you will notice your wrinkles, lumps, and bumps. You will find little tiny hairs growing in the most unusual places and find discolored spots in unwanted spaces. It can chatter your ear off all day about the defects, about your defects, things that nobody will ever notice or care about. A nice haircut and color and some spiffy duds. You might feel like you are a master of this room, but any mishap, like a spill on your shirt, and you could be a slave to it. This room can burn up a great deal of your time and energy and drain your money room dry in the process.
I like how it circles back to the money room, how there is a domino effect to some degree from one room to the next.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the next room is the lemming room. Mm. There's a little monster living in this room that demands you follow all of life's protocols, like moving out, getting married, having kids, hating your life, and working an unfulfilling job. That sort of profiles the first portion of my life.
Absolutely. And many of us.
It also requires you to conform to all the expectations of your family and friends, like keeping up with the Joneses and submitting to gender roles. To top it all off, this room has a special coating that completely blocks the voice of your heart. So, and that's the lemming room, where we're doing what everybody else is doing. The next room is a sex addiction pleasure room. I probably could have written a whole book on this one. we just kept it to a paragraph. The sex addiction pleasure room can get you in all kinds of trouble and awkward situations. For some people, it can also cause inappropriate behavior or steal away precious time and energy from important aspects of their lives. The efforts you'll go through to satisfy the demands of this room can greatly diminish your self-empowerment. What makes you feel in control in one moment can turn around and be the thing that controls you in the next. Having this room under control can be a great asset to enjoying your relationship room. Next, to the relationship room. This room is where you store all your relationship baggage. All the dysfunctional ideas and conditioning you carry from one relationship to the next. You know, which I didn't add in the book, you could also say there's positives. You carry forward positive things from one relationship to the next as well. Mm-hmm. So this room is full of all kinds of stories about relationships and all your distorted and complex needs, most of which are not even close to being practical for a healthy relationship with another human. The skills required to having a great relationship with this room are really simple. You learned most of the things you need to know in kindergarten. Play fair, be nice. It's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. The fear room. This room can be a very cluttered space that takes up a large portion of your mind. You can collect many fears over the duration of your life. However, most of them will be illogical because this room has the power to invoke your imagination like no other. Mm-hmm. Thoughts that are not true, real, or yours can grow into phobias or cause you to become paranoid, leaving you powerless in the process. Not only can this room be the largest room in your mind, it can have a closet in all the other rooms. The fear room in one's mind can disempower the strongest person. Mm-hmm. The guilt and suffering room. The guilt and suffering room is a great hall of disempowerment. This room holds all kinds of whips to punish yourself with. It also holds your most self-defeating thoughts, which will leave you feeling worthless. These two emotions will deplete your energy. If you spend any amount of time in this room, it can greatly diminish your life force. These are just a few of the common rooms that we all share. If you are to learn to transcend your mind, you must take power over all the different rooms in your head. So that's just a basic rundown of the standard rooms that we find in our minds. And I think a lot of us are having similar experiences.
That's why I wanted you to read those, because when I read it, it's not to say that I saw myself specifically in each room, but there's like little fragments of me in each one of those rooms you just talked about. And I don't think that's an uncommon thing. If we're honest with ourselves, and we take a really good look at, as we listen to what you had just said, it's quite possible that you will identify yourself in at least one of those rooms. I would say the money room applies to everyone. I don't think there's a single person on this planet that if you don't have enough money and yet you have bills that don't stop, that's a stress. Mm-hmm. That's something that can really have a pretty negative impact on your relationship room and on your self-image room, all of that, right?
Yeah, and money and fear can be rooted in all different aspects of your mind.